Welcome to the Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Jen Emily. He was an artist, a club kid, and now an alleged killer. Who is the real Christopher Colbert? Joining me in the studio today to answer this question are breaking news reporter Naheed Rajwani.
Hello.
And arts and culture editor Christopher Wynn.
Hi, Jen.
They just reported a story about Colbert, who came to Dallas in pursuit of wealth and fame and left an alleged con man and killer. He is accused of killing Ronald Shumway, hiding his body under a slab of concrete, and posing as him to sell his house. Editorial writer Mike Hashimoto ends the show in our usual way with his latest hashing it out on the impact of police in the courts if we legalize marijuana. Joining us by phone is Fred Robertson, who made a grim discovery last September.
Hi, Fred. We talked a little bit about this story, and you were telling me about how you came across this body. It sounds like, you know, you had invested in this home and hoping of flipping it into kind of a beautiful house with a staircase and a room out of an attic and all that would get you $450,000. Tell us what happened and how all those plans went to waste.
Okay, sure. Well, I do fix and flips in Dallas, and this particular house in North Oak Cliff was really cool because it was in the conservation district, an older house. I was going to convert it from a duplex to a single family home, make it really nice, and the prices in that neighborhood for nice homes were such that I was going to be able to make a pretty good profit and work in that house. So I bought the house. We took a crew out there and started to what we call demo it, you know, tear everything out. And the house had some foundation issues, so we went ahead and fixed the foundation. We spent about 3 weeks working on the house. Now, when I first looked at the house to purchase it, I noticed, you know, in the backyard, in the corner of a backyard, a concrete, you know, kind of box-looking thing. And I thought it was, you know, compost. It was covered with leaves, and I didn't think anything about it. It looked kind of weird, but I thought, well, we'll have to get rid of that, you know, at the end when I do the landscaping. And so we went on our business, and for 3 weeks we completely demoed the house. I mean, we took it down to the studs, fixed all the foundation, and we're preparing to come back and start, you know, the build, right? And one day I showed up at the house and was in the front yard, and, you know, it smelled like a dead animal, you know, like I've had rabbits die in my yard or something, you know, that kind of odor. And I didn't think too much of it. Came back the next day, and in the front yard, it was just worse, you know. And so I had a crew, you know, there was a bunch of junk and stuff underneath the bushes. And I thought, you know, well, let's clean it all out and see if we find an animal, whatever. They cleaned the whole yard out in the front yard and didn't find anything. And so I noticed that walking around to the left side of the house, the odor became much worse. And that's when it dawned on me, oh, that compost pile, because it was up beyond the fence in the backyard on the left side of the house. And I thought, you know what, an animal probably crawled down into that compost pile and died there. So at that point, it was smelled so bad, I said, you know, that was going to be at the end of the project, get rid of that, but it's going today. It smelled so bad. So I took a couple of workers back there and told them, you know, we need to get rid of that and get that out of the yard, which was really funny because I had one of the workers, you know, when he saw the concrete, you know, box or encasement there, he kind of looked at me and, you know, real odd and said, Fred, you know, what if there's a dead body in there? And of course, at that point, I just laughed. I thought he was joking. Or superstitious or something. I said, there's no dead body in there, you know, probably a, you know, some sort of squirrel or possum or something's crawled down in there. And so they took the leaves off and they started breaking it up. It was a concrete box. We noticed there was a hole on the top of it. And I think it started smelling after 3 weeks because an animal probably poked a hole in the top of this concrete encasement. And of course, the odor started coming out. But anyway, they went ahead and proceeded with some hammers and stuff to break it up. And then we noticed a black bag in there. And of course, my worker turned to me again and said, Brother Fred, I got a bad feeling about this, man. What if there's a dead body in there? And again, I thought he was, you know, superstitious. I started laughing. I had a dead body in there, you know. And he's okay. So they went ahead and started digging some more and breaking this box up. A few minutes later, you know, they broke the top open. We could see the bag. They ripped through the bag, and a bone fell out. Now, I was sitting there watching because I was curious, you know, what had gotten in there, what it was. This bone fell out at my feet, and, you know, Charles, my worker, looked at me. He said, "I told you, Fred. I told you, Brother Fred." And I said, no, Charles. It's somebody probably buried their pet there, a dog or something like that. And I'm looking down at this bone at my feet, and I'm trying in my mind to make it match an animal, a dog. But it was clearly a human rib. And I just, you know, after looking at it for 30 seconds, trying to convince myself that this was an animal, I finally looked at Charles. I said, "All right, Charles, you know, let's call the police. Let's let them figure it out."
So what happened next? What happened next?
Well, at that point, we stopped, of course, and I called 911 and told them, you know, I mean, I was kind of embarrassed because I felt they were going to come out and find an animal or something, you know, laugh at me, but I just wasn't sure. This bone was, it looked too real. I mean, I've seen enough skeletons in biology class and stuff in school, right? You know what a human rib bone looks like. So two female officers came out. One of them approached the box there, and, you know, she almost got sick. I mean, she had to move back. The other one was pretty aggressive. She grabbed the pickaxe and started, you know, opening up that bag more. And at that point, exposed a skull and a clavicle. And I just said, "Oh, my gosh." You know, I mean, I couldn't believe it. You know, I mean, of all the houses I could purchase to rehab in Dallas, you know, I have to buy the one with a dead body in the backyard.
And you were telling me that, you know, by that night, you were getting calls from people almost all over the country hoping to talk to you about this house, right? Sounds like you suddenly had just gotten, your phone had blown up with people calling or recognizing that house, or you...
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, within a couple of hours of me calling 911, you know, the street was cordoned off as a crime zone. There were, you know, 50 to 100 neighborhood-type folks on the street wondering what was going on. 15 to 20, you know, police-type cars, including cadaver dogs. They had, you know, a couple cadaver dogs in the house for a couple hours and in the yard. There were three helicopters flying above head. It was quite a scene. And, of course, it was on the news that night on television. And then, you know, subsequent to that, I had, you know, many, many calls from, you know, lots of press, lots of media calling, you know, want to know details and whatnot of what was going on.
Well, Fred, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. I think it adds a lot of value to this, just seeing that there's some humanity in it and all the people that have been involved, especially people who've essentially been pulled into it without having not much to do with it besides just happening to own a house there. So thank you for joining us today.
Sure, no problem.
So, Naheed and Christopher, we now have a body in the backyard. And what happens next? How did they figure out who it was, and how did they go about finding out how it got there?
So, yeah, the body was just the tip of an iceberg now that we know. It was found in September, but the remains were just so decayed, it took a while for the medical examiner to even identify who it was. And, of course, by now, the neighborhood detectives, you know, as we call them, the house detectives, were already like having their theories about who was buried. Was it this homeowner's mom? You know, was it the homeowner himself? So here are a few characters that play out. There's a couple of people that that at this point people think it could be Ronald Shumway, the man who had lived in the house for decades with his mother. You know, he had lived in Oak Cliff all his life. He actually had gone to Sunset High, and he was a part of the student council. He played golf. And then on the other hand, you have this man that he's allowed to move into his spare unit. Again, remember, this is a duplex. He's allowed a man named Christopher Colbert, known as Christian Colbert, into this unit. And This man, and we'll listen a little bit, hear a little bit more about him later, but he's essentially an artist who's kind of seems like he's at the tail end of his career. Things are kind of not going so well for him. Ronald Shumway allows Christopher Colbert to move into a spare unit, and it seems like Christian wasn't asked to pay rent, so he's living there for free. So these are the two people that it could potentially be. But of course, people were always wondering, was it Shumway's mother buried? And in February is when we finally get an answer. It's Ronald Shumway. That's the man who's been buried in his own backyard, essentially.
And the remains that were found, it wasn't just the bones. The bones, the hands were tied with neckties.
Yes. So police, the medical examiner, we haven't been able to get the autopsy report from the medical examiner, but police records say that he was bound by neckties and that he had ligature marks. So it's very interesting to see not only is this man buried, but there seems to be an indication that there was some violence involved.
And so what happens next? How do we get from they identified him and to having a suspect?
Well, detectives start kind of looking into this by saying, okay, let's go through the people who've owned this house, basically the chain in command of this house. Clearly it's been sold a few times. So they trace the sale back to this investor named Connor Steinbrook. He, just like Fred Robertson, he's kind of involved in this business of, you know, selling houses and trying to make money off of them, which is pretty common, especially in the Oak Cliff area, because, you know, home values are increasing. But Connor Steinbrook says he met a man in May who was claiming that he was Ronald Shumway. He claimed, you know, my mother has died. I want to sell my house. How quickly can I sell my house? Things like that. And from there, the sale does go through this man who at this point, Connor Steinbrook, the investor, believes that it is Ronald Shumway. This man has documents. He's bringing documents of the house, the original stuff. He's sending emails through Ronald Shumway's email address and all these things. So Connor Steinbrook does believe that at this point that this is the man who claims to be him, right? And then the sale goes through, and the day of the sale, Connor Steinbrook says that Christopher Colbert was surprised and angry that he wasn't going to walk away with cash the day of the deal. And the sale was for about $109,000. So it's a lot of money. And typically it's transferred through checks and banks. But it was strange to them, but they didn't think much of it. It wasn't suspicious enough for them to report it to anybody or believe that anything was going on. So police started looking into this man who was pretending to be Ronald Shumway, because police believe that Ronald Shumway was killed on April 23rd, 2015, and May 17th is when this imposter was essentially going around town trying to sell this house.
And so how did police figure out who the imposter was, or at least who they believe the imposter to be? Did they have a lot of suspects to narrow it, or did they have one person in mind from the get-go?
It's hard to tell, but it seems like a lot of people knew that Colbert had been living in the spare duplex. For instance, Colbert had been seen driving Shumway's car around. He'd been telling his former neighbors in Carrollton that he'd been living with this man named Ronald Shumway, who he said was his DART driver. Ronald Shumway was a DART driver for 5 years. And the way that police identified Christopher Colbert as the murder suspect in this case was they did a photo lineup and they asked any of the people that were involved in the sale to identify him. And that's how they determined that this was their suspect.
And was he picked out of the photo lineup?
Yes, he was picked out of the photo lineup, according to court records.
And so now that Christopher Colbert, who I keep wanting to call Christopher Colbert because of Stephen Colbert and the Colbert.
And we'll talk about that.
Yeah, it's very confusing. All the whole time I'm like, Colbert, Colbert, Colbert. But anyway, so what happened to Colbert? Where is he at this point?
He is on he's in jail in L.A. He's awaiting extradition. We haven't heard what's going on with that. You know, it could take a while. It seems like, you know, his court date keeps getting moved. But we're definitely keeping an eye on it. So we'll see where he ends up and whether he does come back to face the charges here.
So he was living in L.A. when the police put it all together, and when Colbert was identified in the lineup, he was already out in L.A.?
We don't know for sure. Oh. It's possible he may have had connections elsewhere, and I think we'll have to see. And once he comes back, I think there'll be more details about what actually happened.
And so Colbert isn't exactly a stranger to the Dallas Morning News or to you, Christopher. You actually had a sort of tangential connection to him. You weren't close friends or anything, but your paths crossed.
Yes, Colbert used to cut my hair. Colbert, for most of his career, was a hairdresser. That was his primary career. And in the mid-90s, he was my hairdresser and cut my hair. And I can tell you from knowing him that he was very charismatic, a very handsome and charming guy, really animated, really funny. And so part of my involvement in the story and the appeal to me of doing this was trying to reconcile in my mind how that person ended up in this place. Because they're two very different people, seemingly, in my mind.
And he had been in the Dallas Morning News before. We have a somewhat eerie, maybe telling portrait of him with a piece that he did as an artist. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, we have. And I discovered it when I started working on the story. We have kind of an eerie photo from 1998 of Christian photographed at the MAC, the McKinney Avenue Contemporary. They were having an art night, and he created a piece that looked like sort of a broken mirror, all splintered, and the piece was called Cracked, taken by a photographer that I work with still all the time now. And it's sort of an eerie shot of Colbert kind of looking, not at the camera, but looking into the reflection. You see the reflection of his face and sort of this very soft smile. And it was sort of a weird moment of foreshadowing how his life would unfold. You know, Christian Colbert wanted to be rich and famous, as I say in the story. He grew up in a small town of Tahlequah, Oklahoma. According to his partner that I spoke with, he was an accident child. His closest siblings were about 20 years older than he was. He watched his dad die when he was 9 years old. His dad died of bone cancer, and he watched that slowly and painfully happen. And so he had a lot of baggage. And Colbert's partner, Nathan Cross, said that Christian had trust issues that continued to affect his relationship and all the relationships that he had after that. As for the name, his name is Christopher Colbert. When he came to Dallas in the early 90s, he began getting work as a hairstylist. He went to beauty school. One of the places he worked at, there was another Christopher on staff, and they weren't allowed to have two people with the same name. So he went by Christian instead. And it was not until later in life that he tried to sort of evolve Colbert into Colbert, the more sort of exotic sounding Colbert. But as his partner said, it's definitely Colbert with a T.
And I believe it was his partner who said in the story that Chris or Christian or Christopher, whatever mm-hmm. his name is at the moment, yeah. That he was like a cat, that he, and I can't remember the exact quote, but mm-hmm. he said he could be your friend, but then he could turn on you.
Exactly. He could be your friend one moment, but he could turn on you. You know, Christopher was very charismatic and social, but also could be angry and quick-tempered. And I should back up and say that Nathan Cross, his former partner, this has been obviously very difficult for him. They haven't been together for a long time, but he wanted to sort of tell us more of his story. So to add more of a dimension to who Christopher was. He was a very caring and sincere guy, but yes, he was quick-tempered and angry. Nathan describes him as very creative and talented, but sort of bad with people and a bad manager. He could be very demanding and feisty and temperamental, and at times he could get very angry. And so you begin to get a sense of how somebody could sort of snap or react. Christopher worked through various salons throughout Dallas in the 90s. And in 2005, his kind of highest profile gig was with Face for Men, a new salon in the West Village. That's where my path crossed with him again, because I had not seen him in a long time at that point. And Christian was now sort of the front man of this new salon in West Village. It was the height of the metrosexual movement. They wanted all the guys to come in and get their eyebrows waxed. And, you know, and it was a Christian I had not seen before, who was very, you know, super cleaned up and wearing a suit. And he was the businessman, very slick and pulled together. And from what I have since learned, that was not a great relationship. He was apparently very difficult to work with. He didn't last. The salon didn't last. And things never quite came together for him after that.
And there are great photos of him through the years that are online. Everyone should go to DallasNews.com and look for Cracked, is what you guys called the story after his
Our interactive editor, Dana Emma here, she used that as sort of inspiration for her visual design.
And so you have Christopher, you know, with the art. You have him looking all put together when he was the face of the salon in the West Village. And then there's another one where it looks like he's at a party.
Yep, he's at a costume party at the Stoneleigh Hotel, dressed as Edward Scissorhands, which is kind of a clever nod to his profession at the time. But he loved to sort of dress up, and he was very much kind of a club kid. A former Dallas Voice writer that I spoke with described him as sort of a postmodern club kid who was trying to kind of make his way in cultural Dallas and become part of that scene. And that's how a lot of people described him, that Christopher or Christian was sort of constantly trying to find a place, create an identity. When he struggled to keep steady work as a hairdresser, he made leashes at one point that he sold for money. He picked up a job for a while with the Dallas Voice, taking freelance, you know, party photographs. You know, he was constantly trying new things. But he also struggled with drugs, and he became increasingly sort of strung out. At one point, he fled to L.A. And got very strung out and called Nathan, kind of the only person he had left that he could call, to come and rescue him and bring him back.
What happened to the house that it really seems that maybe nobody owns because Shumway was killed?
So the man we listened to at the beginning of this podcast, Fred Robertson, he actually did own the house. He had title insurance on it, which means that if, you know, there are questions of a title or its validity or whatever, you can file a claim with the insurance company and get the money back. So Fred has since gotten whatever it is that he invested in the house in terms of buying it back. He stole the money that he put in for the renovations. He still lost, but he got a chunk of it back. Robertson actually, in exchange for getting the money back from the title company, actually signed over the deed to them. And currently, Ronald Shumway's half-brother, Mark Shumway, who lives in Houston, is in the process of acquiring that house as his next of kin. Since Shumway's, you know, parents are clearly dead, he has no spouse, he has no children. Therefore, the house now under Texas law can be held by his relatives. And Mark Shumway says he does plan to sell it. He's gotten a lot of calls from people that are interested in buying the house. Again, it's in a part of Oak Cliff that's very, very popular, and people do want those houses. So it's not like there seems to be any issue with it being sold.
It's astonishing if you see the photos of that house and the shape it's in, that house can command up to $450 renovated. It says a lot about what's happening in that neighborhood. And the fact that even despite all of the things that have happened there, you would think that might sort of put a damper on interest in this house, but it apparently has not.
Do you guys have any tips for people to avoid being scammed? Because it seems like it was very easy for someone to impersonate Shumway, to to use his email address and perhaps with access to someone's computer, you could do that. But also, you could just create a new email address and just be that person. And with documents and things like that, he was able to impersonate Shumway. Is there anything that you can offer people? Anything they should look out for? What should they do?
So Julie Forrester, who's the associate provost and professor of law at SMU, she said that in this particular case, it seems like a lot of things seem to go wrong, right? There's first a man who allegedly is claiming to be someone who he's not, but he's backing it up with with documents and with email addresses and all that. But also in this case, there was a notary who somehow let this deed go through and the sale go through, and the money from the sale, she allowed it to be transferred essentially to Ronald Shumway's checking account. So there's some questions about, you know, what went wrong here. I guess one thing is to just be on the lookout for people's identification. And if there are some ways, if people seem suspicious, to kind of check out those suspicions. But also, there are some people who do buy title insurance with their homes, just as an added protection, especially investors who are dealing with a lot of money and want to make sure that the sale that they're going to have is going to be valid and not cause them a lot of issues. A lot of them do tend to invest in title insurance. Granted, the process of filing a claim and going through with it for title insurance can be tedious, but it is something that's worth looking into at least.
That's all for today. Thanks for listening. You'll hear the latest Hashing It Out in just a moment. Read Nahid and Christopher's story in Sunday's newspaper or on the web now at dallasnews.com. Remember to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We are at Texas Crimecast. Thanks to our sound engineer, Tommy Newell. For Nahid Rajwani and Christopher Wynn, I'm Jen Emily. We hope you stay safe out there. Now we drop the mic.
You might think police departments, including those here in Texas, would have better things to do than stay eternally vigilant against the scourge of marijuana. You would be right if today's rising violent crime stats are any gauge. Before you jump on the legalization bandwagon, as Colorado, Washington, Alaska, and Oregon have done, remember where you are. Dallas is our state's third largest city. It couldn't even muster a city council majority this year to take advantage of a 2007 law that allows police to cite and release for low-level pot possession. Instead of arresting and hauling offenders to jail, officers could write tickets and go about their business. The onus was on suspects to find their way to court as if they had run a stop sign. You won't find a city council member or police chief who fails to say, prioritize, when needs outstrip resources, as they always seem to do. Why then can we not have a reasonable adult conversation about an illegal drug that by any reasonable health measure is far less dangerous than legal drugs like alcohol and tobacco, not to mention prescription opioids? The real crime with marijuana is that the feds refuse to remove it from Schedule I prohibition, where it's grouped with heroin and cocaine, and that America still hasn't moved beyond reefer madness to understand the billions and billions of dollars wasted year after year by refusing to tax and regulate it.